Hey, everyone, it's Naomi Wolf of Daily Clout, and I'm so honored and happy to be interviewing our superstar analyst of bills of all kinds, but especially related to business and finance. And that's Charlotte Walker, who's a distinguished entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and has been part of the launch of a number of successful digital companies, including ours. So, welcome, Charlotte. You have a fan base and a following, and we're so glad to have you back.
Well, thank you very much, Naomi. It's always good to and fun to do these.
Wonderful. So we're going to jump right in. You wrote in mid-October for Daily Clout, one of your incredible kind of wrap-up pieces about these bills that are just so impactful, like the HEROES Act and the CARES Act. But that most people really don't understand, including the news media that covers them. And our specialty is diving into the details. So you've done that again in mid-October with an essay called "The New Stimulus Bill Won't Deliver, Not in the Long Term." And that's about what you call the HEROES Act 2.0. So now it's 2 months later, and I want to ask you to give us an update on the legislation.
Okay, well, so HEROES 2.0 was over a $2 trillion act. And of course, when it got to the Senate, it died. And but now a group of bipartisan Congress people have managed to hammer out a good compromise that really, sticks to the essence of what's really needed in the market right now. It's a $908 billion bill,
My gosh.
and that is what is being discussed right now between the Senate and the House. there are some very significant sticking points. I'm happy to say that rental assistance isn't one of them. But the two major sticking points is that the Democrats have been wanting there to be support for municipalities and states that are most, if not all of them, are running at a deficit right now. And there have been very significant layoffs and probably more to come. And they do have some assistance from the Federal Reserve. Which has been helpful in terms of obtaining loans and that sort of thing, but additional assistance is required.
All right,
And the other.
so I just want to jump in and break that down a little bit because it's a lot of information just for people who want to get more of a big picture first. What are some main things, if you would recap, that the act, is intended to do? And then let's go into this question of the cities and rent.
So that's a great idea. So, the framework for the compromise bill is funding for state, local, and tribal governments. That was about $160 billion. Unemployment insurance, extending the plan, having some sort of incremental bonus so that people can get through. That's very critical. Additional support for small business, so the Paycheck Protection Program and the Emergency Program. There's $288 billion in there.
Wow.
There's also support for community leaders. There's some money in there for transportation, the airlines, buses, transit, all that sort of stuff, so people can get around. Testing, development, and distribution of the vaccine. That seems pretty essential to me.
How much is allocated for that?
$16 billion. Healthcare provider relief, also fairly essential. That's $35 billion. For education, schools are struggling. Very often, municipalities have cut back their budgets when actually more money is required. Greenwich, believe it or not, is one city that's done that. Hard to believe. Student loans, there's a $4 billion amount in there. Housing assistance, $25 billion.
Wow.
So these are people who face eviction and could be homeless. There's a whole story around that. Nutrition and agriculture, $26 billion. U.S. Postal Service for, you know, staying afloat.
Right.
Child care, which is a very significant problem. If you have to work and your kids are doing school from home and virtually, there is a broadband, allocation in there of $10 billion, and that sort of plays into the home education.
To extend it to rural areas, is that why, or to help people buy computers for their kids, or
Rural areas, underprivileged, the people that just don't have enough computers.
Right. Huge problem, I'm sure.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And opiate treatment. So, you know, that's it. That's $908 billion right there. And clearly the most critical being extending unemployment, continued moratorium on rental assistance, and all of you. It's really hard to argue that anything should be left out.
Right. Absolutely. No, those all seem like, I mean, it's weird that I haven't heard more debate about what's in this bill and about the kind of importance of this bill, because you hear COVID, COVID, COVID all day long, understandably enough, but really not much granular about the fact that we're a nation in crisis due to this pandemic with horrific sequelae to, you know, the results of closing things down, sending kids to, you know, do their schooling from home, and that we need assistance. It's like, you know, other major crises, like mobilization to help populations when we were fighting wars in World War II, you know, those happened, but we don't really hear in granular detail about what is being proposed or done to assist people. Like I see stories about people lining up for food. I see stories about people being evicted from their homes. I see stories about parents struggling to look after their kids who are, you know, being schooled digitally. But I literally have not heard what you just shared with me, which is this comprehensive breakdown of what kind of help is being proposed, in what form, to what amount. So thank you for that. So now let's go to, you wanted to raise some questions about rental assistance particularly. Can we go back to that now that we have the big picture?
Sure. Yeah. First of all, everybody should know that rental assistance and moratoriums have not been applied uniformly across the country. And there are some states where judges just don't even recognize the moratorium. And there appears to be a lot of discretion on the part of judges and states on how they do recognize this, which is ultimately a major problem. And you as a renter have to know that it exists.
Right.
You know, if you don't even know it exists and don't apply for this assistance, you can't get it. So there's actually, throughout this whole pandemic, there has been a stunning lack of education to the public. No public broadcasts, you know, no nothing,
right.
And no effort to reach everybody that needs to be reached, that needs assistance. So, and we could go on and on and on about that. So that's number one. Number two, I just told you $25 billion was allocated for rental assistance, because you have people who probably don't have a lot of savings. Rent is accruing. They're unemployed. Their unemployment is about to run out. And so they're accruing rent because that they're going to be expected to pay back with interest, most likely, when the moratorium is lifted. Many of them don't have that. And $25 billion is probably only a quarter of what is likely to be really needed based on new studies by, you know, reputable organizations, including the government.
Let me jump in and ask some questions about this so people really understand it. It's really key. When you say judges are not uniformly recognizing rental moratoriums, do you mean, could you explain what that means? You mean the moratorium on evicting people, right? Like right now across the country, people who can't afford to pay rent to their landlords are being allowed to stay in their homes and not evicted for the time being because of a moratorium on evictions, right? But you're saying that those, you know, every month, you know, $1,100 or whatever is adding up. And at the end of this moratorium, these people are going to be expected to pay their landlords that amount with interest. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
And you're saying judges are not uniformly respecting the moratorium, meaning they are allowing landlords to evict tenants in spite of it, or people. And you're also saying people who can't afford to pay rent are not being informed by, you know, public service broadcasting like ours, but really yeah. should be the federal government and state governments, that there is this assistance to allow them to at least have a few months to try to find a way to get another job, pay the rent without getting evicted. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. You know, and as you know, there are no jobs out there, except in highly technical, roles. I think that, a lot of construction has continued and that sort of thing, but there really are no new jobs opening up for the vast majority of Americans.
So what would you, so this bill would give, I mean, let me just like, make it very personal. I'm a tiny landlord. I decided as a feminist that, you know, investing my tiny amount of money in real estate was a very good way to give me some independence as a freelancer and financial security. So I did that. And I see it as a feminist thing because when women own property, they're not at the mercy of, you know, a sexist boss or whatever. So,
yeah.
Having said that, I'm in a terrible situation in New York State as a small landlord rather than an institutional investor because, you know, to date, my tiny, you know, people who live in my tiny properties are not, you know, failing to pay me rent, but they could at any moment, leaving me then unable to pay my bills and unable to meet my obligations because I'm a tiny person. But this is how capitalism works, right? Ideally, I should be free to be an entrepreneur, scrabble together my tiny amounts of money, buy a tiny piece of property, put a tiny tenant in there and, you know, be able to compete in a free market. But what the moratorium has done is mean that I actually think that it's been constructed, at least in New York State, to really hand a gift to institutional investors. And de Blasio is a great example of this because he's specifically, basically creating policies that will lead to, when this all runs out, a moment at which that thousands of dollars, you know, is due for all those low-income people. There are going to be mass evictions. And I think he kind of slipped and said this in March, you know, and we called him on and he walked it back. But, you know, eventually this will run out. It is not sustainable unless the federal government continues to, you know, pay for rent, which maybe they should, but it is not sustainable for small landlords like me. And so when the clock runs out for all these tenants, you know, who for whom my heart is breaking, but also for all these small landlords, there will be huge bargains for institutional investors who could afford to wait it out to snap up all that depressed real estate and then gussy it up, put it back on the market. And when the market rebounds, they will be making vast sums of money. So to me, this issue of real estate mirrors other conversations we've had about policies that in the pandemic that kill mom and pop businesses, kill restaurants, kill that little boutique, that little hardware store. They can't afford to stay open, and they're not being allowed to stay open, but Walmart and Target, who are their competitors, Amazon, is being allowed to stay open. It doesn't make epidemiological sense, but it is a war on small businesses, small entrepreneurs. And you're seeing right now in New York State, Staten Island, restaurant owners who are a tiny lobby, they don't have a lot of power, trying to say, wait, don't kill us, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, there's as you know, millions and millions of small businesses, and they've really, the smaller they are, 200 and less employees have really been hammered. And, you know, the estimates are all over the place. There's just not enough information on this to have good, accurate data, but anecdotally, numbers could be as high as 50% in some locations for small businesses. And I know personally that that's accelerating right now.
Start closing, is that what you're saying?
Yes, they're closing and have closed, are closing. So and it's a massive problem. And you know, the points that you bring up about you know, big landlords, et cetera, being able to come in and swoop up properties for lower deals. This is happening everywhere in every aspect of the economy. You know, private equity companies are picking up companies for a song because of that.
Happening that small businesses are being like swept up by private equity funds and their market. How does that work?
Well, it's throughout the economy. It's just not mom and pop businesses. It's small businesses that just didn't have the economic wherewithal, the capital or the market opportunity. You know, all the companies that are doing well right now are companies that are doing well despite the pandemic, or they're doing better because of the pandemic. So if you're in travel, you know, on location entertainment or restaurants, poor restaurants, oh my gosh, and that sort of thing, you're really struggling every single day to figure out how you're going to put it together. And very rare instances of folks being able to power through that. Right. And you know, it's the metaphor about real estate is in every aspect of the economy.
So taking a big step back and kind of even stepping back from this bill, and I get a lot of questions about this, you are confirming that what's going on in effect, maybe not intentionally, but the result is a massive transfer of wealth from little individual people who cannot make it work anymore to giant corporations, tech companies that can survive in a pandemic, pharmaceutical companies that can survive in a pandemic, private equity firms, you know, institutional landlords. Big players are sweeping up the market share that little players used to be able to at least survive on. Is that correct? Is that a fair way to say it?
I think that that's a very, very fair statement. And, you know, not only that, but the assistance coming out of the CARES Act 1.0 disproportionately benefited the wealthy and big business as opposed to small business. You know, the companies with less than 200 employees never even got the loan at the bank. You know, they were in a waiting line.
You made that point in our last few videos, and it's heartbreaking. And it's so true. I applied for a loan on PayPal and didn't even hear back. And then I read that, like, you know, some big hip hop performer with millions of dollars got a small business loan.
No, so it's just absolutely, absolutely outrageous how it ended up being distributed. You know, you can excuse some of it to the extent that, you know, Congress was trying to get something done quickly, right, and all that sort of stuff. But still, there should have been, as soon as they realized things were happening, there should have been a much stronger response to claw back and new guidelines and that sort of thing.
So let me ask, apart from whether this kind of lockdown is an epidemiological necessity or not, which I am not trained to weigh in on, can I just ask you philosophically, is this still capitalism? Like, if you have a central government deciding whose businesses can stay open, whose businesses can close. I mean, from my study of history, this is not Western capitalism anymore. It's a centrally planned economy of some kind in which central governments and big corporations are kind of divvying up, you know, futures. What would you say, from your background as a business person, is this actually capitalism anymore?
Well, you know, Naomi, that's a very, very big question. we could go on about that. But no, I would say we have definitely, under this administration, created more of a socialist economy than I have ever imagined. And it has been to the benefit of the wealthy and large corporations, not the little guys.
Well, this is why I love talking to you. You say it so concisely, and objectively, and that is really what's happening, socialism for big corporations. And I just want to say, like, about that, I'm a red diaper baby. My dad was a communist, and I'm of a tradition and a generation of you know, kids of Jewish immigrants who thought that the kind of attacks on socialism were overblown and tendentious and ridiculous. But I literally am, and I'm on the left, but I am literally seeing socialism in a not great way that is serving giant corporations being instituted in a way that I would say is really un-American. And I never thought I would live to say that. And I never thought with my, you know, political upbringing, I would live to be critical of socialism, which is basically centrally planning the economy and serving the wealthy. That is my point of view. It's not yours or Daily Clout's. So you address the partisan agendas in your view. And so my last question is, what are the likely outcomes of this bill? What do you see happening?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the biggest sticking points is, you know, business liability during this. And that really just needs to be thrown out because it's
liability for the uninitiated.
So if, you know, your business shutdowns or reopens and you get COVID, you can sue your company. There has been very, very little of that. I mean, not even in the tens or hundreds. You know, it's been tiny for a nation. That type of lawsuit has just not been happening. And Republicans are pushing very hard to include this liability protection in the act. And I think it's ridiculous because it's very, very hard to sue and win in those types of situations. So
what's the downside of including that as a protection? Like, I can see that a lot of small restaurants would not want to reopen for fear of being sued. And I mean, I just think about my own synagogue, really, which I would love to worship in. I'm not of an age that is, you know, endangered if I am physically more than 6 feet apart. I would like to be in a room with other humans safely to worship. And I can imagine that my synagogue is afraid of being sued if someone gets sick. So, and they're not even a business. What's wrong with those protections? I mean, I think that would allow actually a lot of people to make their own independent informed choices about whether they want to congregate or not.
Well, yes. Well, there are tremendous protections already because of the difficulty of bringing a lawsuit. So, I think that's my argument. It's that this shouldn't be a sticking point because there's already tremendous protections for businesses in this regard. It's tough to bring a suit along those lines.
Is it tough to win or tough to bring a suit? Because I could see small businesses being scared to defend. You know?
To bring a suit, tough to win a suit because of the way, you know, this, you know, the law is structured around this.
So that's,
and I think that, you know, there's good reasons for it because, you know, everybody would be suing everybody else and small businesses would be hurt the most. I don't think we need more protections there than businesses already have.
So would you be happy with the bill as it now stands going through? Do you think that people on both sides should get over their partisan fighting and just pass it as it now stands?
Well, yes, I think they should, because another wrench that has been thrown into this by the Republicans is to severely limit the powers of the Federal Reserve, which, you know, as you know, had it not been for the Federal Reserve literally floating the economy for at World War II levels of capital versus GDP. You know, things would have been very, very bad. I mean, very, very grim. Many more bankruptcies. I mean, we're going to have bankruptcies and are having bankruptcies, but significantly more. So, that I think is a sticking point that also should be taken out of the mix. And I am pretty confident that they will come to a compromise on that.
Be objecting to the implementation of the Federal Reserve. I would have thought they they like that sort of thing. Sorry for my
Well, ironically, the Republicans, for the first time that I can, I can see in the last 4 years or so, are suddenly worried about deficits. And, we are deficit spending. There's no question about it. But this isn't a time to stop deficit spending.
Ask as a layperson, say the pandemic and the policies that really close small businesses and small landlords, extend for another year. What will prevent our deficit spending at levels that would basically drive the United States into bankruptcy or the equivalent?
Right. Well, I mean, this is the magic question that should actually be put to the Republican Party. You've gotten this far. You've gotten this far with this level of deficit spending. How do you propose to get the economy out of this funk once the pandemic is over? And that's just a whole other conversation. So whatever the parties are agreeing to right now, whether it's the full 908 or excludes the municipalities, we still have spending that needs to happen post the pandemic to get the economy back up and running again.
I don't doubt that, and I understand that. I guess I'm asking for everyone who's watching and doesn't understand this mechanism, what is the limit? Like, say there's another, because this is the second or third such stimulus bill, right? What if there's another $908 billion needed in 6 months because no one can go back to work, and then another $908 billion? Is there any limit to the good faith and credit of the United States? Is there any risk? Like, I accept that this is needed now, but what if it goes on and on and on? What happens to a country when it borrows hundreds of billions of dollars to float people who can't work?
Well, again, an excellent question is, I think that there has been a sense in modern economic theory anyway, that if you're a sovereign country that issues your own currency and all that sort of thing, that you can have limitless spending. Now, of course, there's a consequence to that, and the consequence is inflation and a lower valuation of your currency and that sort of thing. But as long as there are there are buyers of your currency and buyers of your debt, you should be able to continue spending. Now, I don't expect that to happen, and some prudence is required, but the next level of this is going to be spending that will be aimed at stimulating the economy, getting more jobs back into the economy and that sort of thing. And that has a payoff, where it will help grow the economy faster, therefore bring more revenues into, federal coffers and state coffers and all that sort of thing, and, will help reduce the deficit.
Do you think there's a partisan reason that Republicans don't want money to go to cities because cities tend to vote Democratic?
It has crossed my mind. the crazy thing is that, as we have all known from major studies, is that it's primarily blue states that fund the government.
Right.
And it's primarily red states that are net deficit spenders. In other words, they contribute less to federal revenues than they take in terms of federal aid. So I really just don't know what to think of it. It doesn't make there's nothing rational about it. I actually think Republicans are trying to set up the Biden administration to be hand tied.
I'm sorry to interrupt. My last question is, how do you see the new administration, assuming they take over the peaceful transfer of power, how do you see a Biden-Harris administration affecting the outcome of this particular bill?
Well, I think they will have no impact on this bill. I think this bill is probably going to pass before the Christmas, and it just depends what is actually going to be in it. Is it going to be the full 908? Are there going to be these liability protections? Are the Federal Reserve powers going to be curtailed? I think there will be compromise on that, and it will finally get through. So it's really what Biden and Harris are going to be probably very focused on is just making sure the pandemic is being handled correctly. It's been a colossal failure, as I think almost everybody recognizes. So their focus will be on that. And then I think it's getting the economy back up and running again. And I would expect that they will do everything they can to get a bipartisan infrastructure bill passed, which would hopefully accelerate towards a greener economy. The United States is behind in so many different ways. It's you don't even know where to begin. But Europe, China, almost everyone is focused on carbon-free economy in the next, 20 to 50 years. And the U.S. hasn't even made a statement about that and has removed itself from the Paris Accord. But in addition, green jobs are one of the fastest growing segments in the economy right now. A lot of this is happening by itself to some degree. So, my gosh, what if you created some stimulus from the government? What would happen then?
And that in California, for instance, policies that support the development of green technologies on a state level really have yielded good results.
Correct. Almost everywhere there have been green policies, even at companies, that it has improved performance. It's good business to take care of the environment.
Well, on that note, it is a wonderful projection for what I hope will be our next video. And we can't thank you enough. You've given an incredible update of the HEROES Act 2.0. You've shown us what still needs to be done. You've illuminated the partisan agendas, and you've given us a bit of a look forward about what the future may hold. Lastly, if people want to either support or oppose this bill, how would they do that?
Write their congressman. Okay. Make calls to your congressman and say you are for the bipartisan bill that's before Congress.
Or opposed, or the beauty of Daily Cloud is you can embed Charlotte Walker's incredible essay about this, which is up on Daily Cloud. It'll be embedded in this video as well. And you can send that to your member of Congress and say, look, I want more for, college loan payoff, or more for buses and trains, or less. And that's the beauty of actually having a participatory democracy, which we at Daily Cloud allow. Charlotte Walker, thank you so much for another amazing conversation. Stay safe, and thank you for explaining the world of legislation to us.
Thank you, Naomi. It's a pleasure.
Take care.
Bye.